Welcome to the MedTech Talent Lab, the number one catalyst for advancing careers and building high-performance teams. Sponsored by the Anthony Michael Group, helping companies secure in-demand talent in regulatory affairs, quality, clinical, engineering, R&D, and other areas for medical device, digital health, diagnostics, and other organizations across the U.S. life sciences sector. Here's your host, Mitch Robbins.
All right, welcome back to another episode here on the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. Of course, I'm your host, Mitch Robbins, the founder and managing director here at the Anthony Michael Group, building teams and careers across the industry. And today I have the pleasure of sitting down with Miss Mary McNamara Cullinane, who is the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs at ClearPoint Neuro. Mary comes to our show today with a career that spans well over 25 years in regulatory, quality, and clinical within the medical device and biotech space. Mary has helped successfully bring many products to market, having led teams for companies like Echo Therapeutics, Intrinsic Therapeutics, a variety of others, and of course, today here at ClearPoint Neuro. Now, Mary, what's interesting as well, and I can't wait to dig into it, is she's also successfully run her own independent consulting practice over the years, where she has guided several clients across both medical device and biotech industries through the preparation of different complex FDA investigational device exemptions, pre-market notifications, requests for classifications. She's got experience with the de novo pathway and so much more. Now, if you aren't familiar with ClearPoint Neuro, the company is a device, cell, and gene therapy enabling organization offering precise navigation to the brain and spine. The organization provides both established clinical products as well as preclinical development services for controlled drug and a device delivery. And so without further ado, Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I am thrilled that you're here. We've been in talks for a while to get this going, and the day is here where we get to have this conversation. So thank you for that. You know, with so many of the episodes, I like to try and go back in time first to help understand what we're talking about today. And it's great to be able to go way back in time when we talk about formative years to really kind of get a sense of your upbringing and kind of help how it helped shape your future endeavors. So with that, what was home life like? Where'd you grow up? What was your family situation like? Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I grew up outside of Boston, Massachusetts. I am the youngest of eight. My parents absolutely instilled in me a very hard work ethic, which has helped me through regulatory affairs. You know, I had a number of jobs, you know, mostly waitressing, which I think is a hard position to have. And, you know, it's physically demanding and there were a lot of hours in there. But, you know, again, that instilled and that with my parents' support really instilled a great work ethic. And I basically stayed in the Boston area my whole life. And luckily for me, you know, there are multiple medical device and pharmaceutical and biotech companies around this area. So I really didn't need to move too far to find a number of positions that I'm sure we'll talk about.
That is for sure. Yeah, you're lucky when people talk about, hey, I kind of stayed around here. It's one place to stay around, kind of the biotech and device capital of the East, for sure.
Right.
And if not,
yep.
You know, some would argue of the world. But we can't gloss over the fact that you just said you're one of eight. That
yes.
is a big family. Where do you fall in the pecking order?
I was the baby, the last one.
Wow. And so what's the span in years between the oldest and the youngest?
There's 15 years between
15 years.
Oldest and youngest, yeah.
Tell us more. What was that like growing up? I mean, because when you were born, your oldest sibling was 15. So the first couple probably were already out of the house by the time you started to be an active kid running around yourself. But what was that like?
Right. It was great. I mean, I really liked being part of a big family. I didn't really remember my older sisters much. There were five girls, the first part of the family. And when my oldest sister came home from college, I asked my mother who she was because
Oh, wow.
I didn't remember her that much. But, you know, it was like having a lot of mothers and a lot of great friends because, you know, I had a bunch of sisters taking care of me as a young baby, toddler and child. So it was a busy time. We had big family gatherings. Yeah, so it was fun. It was great being from a large family.
That's awesome. And, you know, you mentioned the work ethic piece. I can imagine that there was a lot of delegation going on in the house to the kids, huh? From your parents?
Correct. That's right. Absolutely. Although the older siblings thought that I didn't have too much to do because I was the baby.
Yeah.
But, oh, yeah. I mean, my parents were, you know, the World War II generation where you really had to work hard to make your way. And there was no getting around that. So, yeah, that really helped shape my career.
You know, I was a waiter for a while myself. And one of the things I've always said about our country is, you know, you look at Israel. In Israel, everybody has to serve in the military for a period mm-hmm. of time. Women, men, when you become of age, you serve in the military. I think it's a minimum of 2 years. I can't remember. Maybe it's four. I always felt like everybody in America should serve in a restaurant. Because yeah. I think, one, you learn how to treat people. Two, you learn proper etiquette. And three, you learn what not to do, right?
By some
of the folks that you wait on.
Correct.
So I empathize with that experience that you've had. And I know how hard it is and
yeah.
how much those folks go through, especially during busy times. Have you ever had the nightmare where you're the only server on staff and the restaurant fills up?
I think it's probably happened, actually. Yeah. I actually really enjoyed it. I liked the physicality of it, the running around, the taking orders. Yeah, it could be really difficult and demanding, but I kind of liked that, you know, doing a number of things at the same time.
What held your interest as a kid?
I always liked science and medicine, but I, you know, through high school, I realized that I wasn't very good in emergencies. Like if, you know, I didn't like blood, I didn't like that kind of thing. But I was always very, very interested in science. So that was again, led me to where I am today, which is a mix of science and business. And then, of course, I liked sports. I played a few sports in high school and in college.
And part of the reason I ask you that is because I'm always intrigued by how people got into this business. We always joke, yeah. Nobody comes out of school saying, I'm going to be a regulatory affairs expert and I'm going to build my career on that. Usually, one thing happens, same with recruiting, quite honestly, right? We don't come out of school saying, I'm going to be a headhunter.
Right.
Something happened along the way, and the rest is history. But you took a liking to science very early on. How did you get into our crazy world of device and specifically regulatory?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Like, you know, when I started out, it's very different than today, because today you can find masters of regulatory affairs programs, you know, in a number, I think 10 or 20 universities now. I started in research and at Brigham and Women's in Harvard in the renal division and as a technician. And then from there, I got a position at a small in vitro diagnostic company where I was a bench scientist trying to better the in vitro diagnostics, but also started doing some consumer testing with the IVDs. And then from there, I realized I kind of liked that consumer testing part of it. And that led me to work for C.R. Bard as a clinical affairs coordinator, where I was, you know, managing clinical studies. And part of that role was regulatory. So that is where I started in regulatory. So I went from, you know, being a research technician to a scientist to doing some consumer testing with in vitro diagnostics to clinical affairs and then into regulatory affairs. And like you said, there was no straightforward pathway at that point, right? People kind of fell into it either from quality or clinical or attorneys or nurses kind of fall into regulatory affairs as well.
Mm-hmm. So at that point, you very easily could have built a career out of clinical, right?
Yes.
You could have just kept going. Why did you take a liking to regulatory and keep going down that route?
Mm-hmm. I think for me, clinical was, I don't want to say monotonous, but, you know, you did a lot of the same thing over and over again. managing the studies and going out to sites and comparing notes from the doctors or the coordinators to what you have on file. So I liked the regulatory aspect where you really had to get an understanding of the device or the technology. You had to learn about the testing that was required for that technology, and you had to build in a strategy. So it took a lot of understanding of the product and the technology, but you had to build in a strategy as well. And I think I liked that component, that there would always be something new to strategize on and learn about.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you started to talk about the fact that there's these emerging programs. Some have been out there for quite some time, but the opportunity to get a master's, you know, in regulatory or master's in regulatory and quality, et cetera. As a regulatory executive, what's your opinion on these programs? And it's a little bit of a loaded question, so I think I'm going to stop there and just leave it open and see where you go with it first. What's your opinion of these programs?
Yeah, so I actually, I taught a couple of classes at Northeastern for their master's program. I think they're great programs. I think they're a great introduction for like new college graduates or people maybe that have been in clinical or quality and maybe want to move into regulatory, because it will introduce them to you know, what regulatory is all about. So I think they're a great introduction. It certainly won't give you, you know, 5 years of experience in regulatory just because you have that master's. That just takes time to gain that experience. But I think they're good programs. I think they're worthwhile and they add value, to anybody who wants to pursue those.
I appreciate that vantage point and your comment on that. I think one of the frustrations I hear from the industry, from industry leaders, is that these folks come out with their master's degree and they think that they're ready to take on the world and they've got all this experience because of what they learned in their program, versus somebody who has been rolling up their sleeves in the thick of actual strategy for an organization. And it's a hard bridge because people are thinking, well, I just went through this. It's a rigorous coursework. I do have experience. I did these projects. And executives are looking at it, it's like, great, you proved that you can jump through some hoops and stick with something, but that doesn't replace the fact that you need hands-on experience. And I think there's a rub there.
Agree. And I think if you come out of those schools with a master's in regulatory, you're still going to be really considered entry level, right?
Yes.
You're going to be an entry level regulatory affairs professional.
Thank you for saying that out loud, because it's you instead of a third party like me saying that. The teams, I mentioned, you know, some of the companies that you've worked for over the years. We're going to talk about your consulting practice in a little bit, but what has been roughly the average scope of the teams you've led? How many people and the types of people that you've led?
Yeah, so probably the largest team I led was about 8 people. I really haven't been at a lot of large medical device companies. When I was at the largest one, I wasn't in a managerial role there, but I've been at some startups and mid-level companies. So probably about 8 employees was the largest group that I managed.
Was that regulatory specifically or and quality?
That was regulatory specifically.
So I've got to imagine that was perhaps a mix of, you know, varying levels of specialists, maybe a coordinator, some associates. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yep.
In your experience, what makes an outstanding regulatory specialist compared to somebody who can, you know, you at least don't have to fire them because they're getting some work done?
I would say somebody who would be considered outstanding would be somebody who is proactive in researching what they need to be doing every day. I mean, you can give all the, you know, training and managing those people and providing them information on specific projects or technology. But to me, somebody who takes the initiative and is proactive in understanding the regulations surrounding a product or project or device is really worth their weight in gold. More so than somebody who does do the work but doesn't really have an understanding of why they're following a specific regulation or where to look for a specific, you know, set of guidelines for a certain technology. So I would say a person that's, you know, really proactive and takes initiative in understanding and researching what they're doing.
Do you think that's ingrained in somebody's DNA and work ethic and mindset, or you think that's something that can be learned?
I think it's both, right? So I think you can have it, you know, as an innate characteristic, but I also think it can be, you can train somebody on that, but it doesn't mean everybody would do it, right? So you can impart those, you know, try to get them to follow that kind of a road, but it doesn't mean that it will become innate with them. But I think it's really important. It's a really important characteristic, just that initiative and proactiveness.
I'm going to put a few words in your mouth because I think you're also saying this, but I've heard the proactive piece makes a lot of sense. I think what you're also saying too is understanding the overall objective of the organization and how does the strategy and how does the regulatory activities that the person's doing day to day move the business forward and fit in? And what can we do to almost be basically look out for obstacles ahead of time by understanding the regulations and understanding what are the intricacies of the regulations against what our strategy should be against what the overarching goals of the business are. And somebody who can put those pieces together versus just looking at a chapter and say, okay, next step, we have to do this for our 510K because it says so is a difference maker.
Correct. So you're balancing the needs of the business, the goals of the business, the regulatory, the regulations, and understanding the technology. You have to take all of that into account. And I will say, so I'm going to show my age here. It's very easy to do that these days, right? When I started, there was no internet.
Yep.
You had the CFR, you had to call FDA. Now everything is at your disposal. So not just the FDA website where you can get regulations, guidelines, examples of other products. You can just Google search how is something regulated or what is somebody's opinion on a specific device or technology or how does FDA look at this device? This is all at your fingertips with Google and with the FDA website. So it is actually easier now to be more proactive and take that initiative.
And it's funny how think about where we're at in the year. We're at the beginning of 2025 as you and I record this. People's New Year's resolutions are starting to come apart as we speak, probably. But one of them is always, hey, I want to eat healthier. I want to exercise more. I want to lose weight, whatever it is. The tools are there. Anybody can start doing that tomorrow.
Right.
The drive, the desire, to the master, quote unquote, why is what carry people through to make habit change. Versus those who think it sounds great and want to try for a little bit, but when the going gets tough, they stop. The reason I bring this up is because here you are saying, look, the tools are there. Anyone who wants to be proactive, learn as much they possibly can about where their device fits in as far as how the notified bodies, FDA, looks at this. They want to learn from their mentors internally. It's all right at your fingertips. It's a matter of, do you have the tenacity and the drive and the reason to do it, right?
Right. Exactly. Yep.
That's
and
awesome.
Like you said, there's the tools are there for you. It's just a matter of, you know, finding them, using them to your advantage and learning all about what you're doing, understanding the regulations, the guidelines, and where you're going, what your company goals are.
As a regulatory executive, what do you find to be the most challenging part of your role?
I would say the most challenging part of the role is actually doing what we were just talking about. It's having an understanding of what the company goals are and trying to meet those goals, but keeping up with the regulations and obtaining approvals on behalf of a company are sometimes not completely in sync, right? Because regulatory bodies are not always easy to deal with. And a lot of it can be out of your control completely, especially now with MDR. Changing regulations even in the United States. So, gaining an understanding and also managing expectations of leadership within your company, right? Because you need to tell them in a realistic manner, you know, what are the chances of getting something approved or cleared within X number of days? How much that might be out of your control, no matter how hard you work or no matter what great package or submission you do. So one is like, you know, managing expectations of leadership, understanding and keeping up with all the regulations and the guidelines from all the regulatory bodies. And again, another example, is, like I said, MDR, the MDR regulations in Europe. That's very, very difficult hurdle right now. And then, you know, balancing all of that to make sure you're doing the best you can for the business, communicating with the regulatory bodies, and, you know, working on and submitting the best submissions you can.
I've got to imagine that as the person where the buck stops from a regulatory standpoint, it's a really hard place to be when the CEO has a vision and the investors have, poured money in and they want a return on their investment. And the regulatory person is sitting there having a dissenting opinion because of what they know about the regulations. And that's probably why they say the best folks know how to operate in the gray and get comfortable being uncomfortable, whereas regulations say this, our company needs to do this. Where is the happy medium so we can ride that line that we need to ride, but get our products to market and stay commercialized? Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because there's got to be several meetings in the course of your career where you've been sitting there as the one who probably had to be the, you had to have a spine.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, so I've had, many examples in my career of really difficult situations from a, regulatory perspective of managing expectations. So I would say, again, managing the expectations of leadership or clients, like if you're a consultant, and so that they understand what the realistic timelines are for approvals or clearances for certain technologies. I have had companies ask me to put out, weigh in on how likely something is to get approved or cleared. And they said, come on, it's 50-50. Is it 80-20? And they really put pressure on me. And I said, I really don't like to do this, but okay, if you're forcing me to, I'll say 80-20, we're going to get a clearance within X number of days. Well, I learned my lesson there because that didn't happen. And the CEO of that company got in touch with the CEO of my former consulting company to say that I had told them it was a slam dunk, which I had not told them it was a slam dunk. They forced me to put some percentage weight on how likely the clearance or approval is. So I really learned a lesson. That was very early on in my career, to never make promises that were not realistic. Tell them, ideally we might get a clearance or an approval in X number of days, but it's more likely to be much longer than that. So again, just managing those expectations and managing difficult personalities. Because a lot of times the leadership teams want you to submit deficient submissions, right? They want to just get something into FDA or a regulatory body to get it sitting there. But if you don't have all the information that is required, it's just going to come back to haunt you. And it usually takes much longer. So if you really want to be successful, you put a complete submission to FDA. If you put in a deficient submission, it's going to take much longer than if you had put in the complete submission. It's not the same amount of time. It's much double the time and more expensive usually.
Really, really, really valid points. What else do you think, you've seen a variety of different circumstances. What do you think a lot of organizations get wrong about regulatory? And what I mean by that is the way they look at regulatory.
Yeah, I would say probably what most organizations and leadership can get wrong about regulatory is that we have control of everything, which we don't. We don't have control of how FDA or regulatory body is looking at the submission, and we don't have control of the timelines.
Yep. The other thing, I'm trying to get inside your mind as much as I can, because I think it's so valuable for others to hear kind of what is it like, within the world of a regulatory leader who's responsible for it. A big reason why products come to market or don't.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think other executives should be aware of that folks like yourself within regulatory are thinking about or really stressing about?
Mm-hmm. Probably, I would say they should be thinking about, everybody on the team, say, that's involved with a submission, of doing their part and doing their part well. So the engineers have to provide, you know, device descriptions and testing. Marketing has to provide labeling and claims. And so all of those components are very important. The regulatory person usually gets those all together and submits those to the regulatory body. So what we're thinking about is working with all the different teams at one organization and making sure each of those teams is doing their part and doing their part well, because we are dependent upon each of those teams within an organization to do a good, solid, well thought out, comprehensive submission.
As I think it through, like, it really is a tough place to be in regulatory, because you've got engineering with design and the way, and regulatory has to push back, say, on the engineering piece. Then you've got marketing who wants to stretch what labeling basically stretch the message as far and wide as possible. And then regulatory has to get involved, say, well, we can't say this, we can't say that. Like, it really is a tough place to be more often than not.
Correct. Right. It really can be. The organization I'm in now, you know, we have an outstanding and competent team. They have a really good understanding of what the regulations are all about and how sometimes our hands are tied in regulatory. But every organization I've been in has not been like that. There's been a lot of pressure. There's, you know, been different groups trying to cut corners, which again just leads to a rejection of your submission.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's the biggest takeaway from the last few minutes is that done right the first time, and racing to the FDA's desk for them to review something that's, for lack of a better term, half-ass, is only going to come back to bite you, because then you have to redo things. And then it's months and months more down the line for them to review it. And then you kind of lose trust with the person that you're working with at the FDA, because now they're going to be more scrutinous. So
Correct. And even done right leads to questions, right? So even a perfect submission, you're going to get questions from FDA. And you bring up another good point, and that is this. I've worked with a number of companies that their entire strategy is to put in deficient submissions and just try to push the envelope, right? Well, if you're always pushing the envelope with FDA or any regulatory body, you're going to get a reputation with them, and they're going to scrutinize your submissions even more, and they're not going to like you. I mean, I've worked with FDA for long enough that I know they really do try to be independent, but if you have a reputation for putting in deficient submissions, you're going to get, you know, that's going to carry through all your submissions at FDA, and they may be more difficult and ask you harder questions because of that.
Well said. I want to talk about your consulting experience and kind of leading your practice, but there's a couple other things I want to touch on first. With the FDA, the new change in our government's administration and perhaps, you know, some of the things that have been out there as far as things turning over, any opinions or thoughts on, you know, FDA specifically coming up?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I mean, I kind of fear what can happen. I certainly hope everything will be left as is. I mean, every organization at a federal level can be improved. But I really feel that, I've been working with FDA for almost 30 years. And, you know, for the most part, they are reasonable people trying to do their job to ensure that the public gets safe and efficacious devices and drugs and biologics. So I certainly hope that continues. I'm a little worried for other areas of FDA, like the food areas, just because that's been one thing that's been talked about. And I get a lot of the email alerts from FDA, and I have a pretty good understanding of how FDA monitors foods. And if we let any of that go, you know, you're going to see an uptick in diseases in foods, right? Yeah. So when you see those alerts once in a while, like listeria in spinach or E. coli in hamburger, that's going to go up significantly if FDA inspectors are let go. I do know that there has been an influx of applications for retirement at CDRH. In devices. So people are trying to leave the agency ahead of the administration change, which
will
be unfortunate.
That's what I wanted to ask you, if you're hearing anything from the inside.
Which will be unfortunate, because that will lead to, longer review times for all devices, biologics, drugs, and so on.
Yep. Well, time's going to tell. There's going to be change one way or the other. That we know.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of how it plays out.
Yep.
Coming more to something that is tangible and is the life you've led, you know, you have very successfully run your own consulting practice. And
correct.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, you've done it both in a part-time ad hoc capacity as well as full-time.
Correct.
In the last 18 months, at least, in the course of my career, I have never seen it this tough for the regulatory and quality space specifically. And there are a ton of good folks out on the streets who are complaining about not being able to find work. And that's a fact. I live it every day. One of the trends that I'm seeing is that people are getting frustrated, or they're thinking, hey, I'm out anyways. Maybe now's the time. Let me just take the leap and start up consulting. And what I normally see is a bright smile, a huge, you know, a boost of confidence. I can do this. I know what I'm doing. They are excited because they've got some contacts in the industry who they're close with, and they give them some immediate work. And immediate work goes by the wayside, and lo and behold, oh my gosh, I'm running a business. I don't know how to develop business. Should I be a consultant? Should I work for a consulting firm? Maybe I should start interviewing again full time. I would love your perspective as to, one, why did you go down that road in the first place when you did? And then, two, let's just talk through some real life experiences of running a consulting practice.
Yeah, so when I left the small in vitro diagnostic company I was at, where I was doing some bench testing, plus I was in consumer affairs doing some consumer testing, that is when I started my consulting career. I went to a small company in outside of Boston called Medical Device Consultants Incorporated, and I started as a research assistant, and I left as a senior consultant. It is there I got the bulk of my experience. That was 17 years. That was really my sort of formative years. When you're in consulting for that long of a period of time, you are going to get experience in everything and anything, right? So just name, you know, any therapeutic area, right? So orthopedic, wound care, neurology, you know, cardiac, in vitro diagnostics, you know, just about ophthalmics, just about everything I was exposed to, along with hundreds, if not thousands, of technologies, and probably, you know, every submission type possible, right? And I had great mentors there. They were former FDA chiefs of staff, so they were great. And I also had a flexible schedule, so we can talk about that remote part. I know you want to talk about that in a minute. So it was there I got the bulk of my experience, which was just fantastic. And I loved consulting then because I felt like, again, just what I just talked about, it was very varied, right? You always had something different to work with. You weren't just, you know, so if you were at a larger company and you were in, say, just working with endoscopes, that's all you did was endoscopes, right? But if you're in consulting, you're doing hips and knees or wound care or cardiac implants or defibrillators or ophthalmoscope. So many different devices. It kept it interesting. I was always learning. And then I was learning from great mentors. So that's why I stayed there for that long. What was interesting was when I did go to leave that consulting firm, and I'd been there 17 years, I had a hard time getting back into industry because I kept getting the same question during interviews. Well, are you a consultant or do you want to be part of a company?
Yep.
I don't know why that was. I mean, I wouldn't have been interviewing if I didn't want to move back into industry. But I, you know, because I was there for 17 years, I'm not quite sure why they, I mean, I guess I understand why they asked the question, but I did want to get back into industry at that time. But I got great experience in that consulting capacity.
And then, and I want to touch on what you just said about kind of the vibe that you were getting when you were interviewing at the time. But after that, is that when you started your own? Did you start your own?
So a couple of clients did follow me at that time, and I was able to continue working with them. So I did continue. When I went to a couple of different startups, I continued to do a little bit of consulting on the side because those clients wanted to follow me.
Okay. But for the most part, you worked for that firm as a consultant.
Correct.
Got it.
Then I was at a startup, and then when I got laid off from that startup, then I went full-time back into my own consulting.
Okay. And you did that just based on the time and the place of what had happened with the startup?
Correct. And, you know, I was kind of loyal to these. They were loyal to me, and they really wanted to continue to work with me because they'd worked with me for so many years. And I was loyal to them as well. And I didn't want to just leave them hanging in the middle of projects.
So then was most of your business at the time as a consultant from that previous organization, are you saying, or?
Some of that was, and then I did have other companies get in touch with me just through LinkedIn or just heard about my reputation and they got in touch with me as well.
What did you like about the idea of basically running a practice, running your own thing?
I guess determining, you know, the types of projects that I wanted to take on, the types of clients I wanted to take on, managing my own time. And again, it was, you know, pretty interesting because it was different types of varied projects, varied technologies, and varied submission types as well.
You know, and then when you went back to industry, I'm sure you leveraged consultants from time to time to help with different projects. Over the course of the last few years, are you seeing an uptick as far as the number of folks who are reaching out, propositioning you about their services independently or not necessarily?
Yes, absolutely. A big uptick. And I think there's a few reasons for that. One is because, I mean, I think a lot of companies have pared down their groups, their regulatory groups. I mean, I think there has been some layoffs. But I also think there are most companies like NAMSA or Emergo or like UL and Toxicon, they all started out as test labs, but they all now have regulatory arms. And that didn't exist before, right? So all these test labs now have some regulatory personnel to take on, you know, work for, you know, companies that come to them for testing, and then they can do their regulatory submissions. So I think there's almost a glut of regulatory professionals. You know, whether they're competent or not is different, is a different story, because, you know, I've had some companies come to me who've had bad experience. It's some of those organizations. But I think there's so many small companies or consulting companies in different areas now offer a regulatory arm. So there's a lot of regulatory professionals out there to choose from.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to touch on, and that is what I've noticed in the feedback that I get from top regulatory executives about consultants is that there's a difference between somebody who's got a lot of years of industry experience and then went off to do some consulting versus a true consultant who is thinking like a consultant, who is presenting like a consultant, who is making decisions like a consultant. And I think that's a very different mindset. Somebody who's going to come in and tell an organization like it is because that's what they're being paid to do, versus somebody who's used to falling within a corporate structure, who takes that and comes to the consulting landscape and kind of acts, thinks like they used to think. Does that make sense? Do you know what I'm saying as far as the difference?
I do. Yes, I do. So there are consultants that can put their, put themselves in a company's shoes to understand what they're doing, what their expectations are in terms of regulatory submissions. And then there are others that are really, they don't really have a good understanding of how to do that consulting. I feel like you said, they're kind of filling time maybe between jobs. And the other thing that is challenging when you are a consultant is a lot of companies will consultant shop. So what they'll do is they'll go around to a number of different consultants, and if you are not giving them a realistic idea of what their project's going to take, then they may hire you because you may provide them with the path of least resistance, right? So you may provide them with the easiest pathway or not a realistic pathway. If you're a good consultant, you're going to do your research and have an understanding of the strategy. And you may tell that client that it's going to take 1 to 2 years versus somebody else might say 6 months, but that person is not being, you know, realistic. That other consultant's not being realistic, and they don't have an understanding of what's really necessary. But that's a lot of businesses will do that. They'll consultant shop for the right answer, the fastest time frame, but that's not actually what might be good for them as an organization.
And for companies that don't have a full-time regulatory representative yet, and they're relying on consultants, it's a make or break thing a lot of times. You get the wrong strategy, you know, we always say regulatory strategy early and often, really don't make it a afterthought. It's got to be super early. But if you get the wrong advice, you're up a creek.
Absolutely. And like you said, you know, many times you'll work with clients that do have a little bit of experience, but many times you will not, especially foreign clients, like clients from not from the U.S. when you're working with FDA. They are at your mercy, right? Yep. They have no idea what the regulations are, what to expect. So they really are, you know, very dependent on you. And that's why it is, you know, I hear this all the time. It is really hard to find a really good consultant. I mean, some people say they are, but, you know, they have a little bit of experience or they've, you know, dabbled in it. But sometimes it is hard to find a really good, solid one.
What are any particular types of questions that you have asked in the past to try and vet that out, or that you would recommend companies who are listening to this maybe incorporate in their screening?
Yeah, so I would ask questions like, you know, how many submissions have you done, especially in a consulting capacity? You know, what is your communication style with FDA? Because and how many times have you had interactions with FDA? Because many consultants have not. Interact with FDA, and you want to make sure that they're not antagonistic. It's not a sort of an us versus them mentality. You kind of have to be really cooperative and considerate when you're communicating with FDA. So those are the kinds of questions I would ask, like experience and the number of submissions and their communication style and how much communication, you know, have they had with FDA? How many meetings have they conducted and managed with on behalf of clients with the FDA? Because that is really where kind of the rubber meets the road. You have to know how to manage, you know, the client expectations, manage FDA expectations, and conduct a smooth meeting with FDA.
100%. And going back to what you just said, hey, when you were coming, trying to interview in the industry and people are looking at you, are you a consultant? Are you wanting, you know, what do you want here? A lot of times the misconception is, well, she's done consulting, which means she's done bits and pieces of a project, but she's never really seen it through start to finish, from concept through commercialization. We need somebody who's going to be an anchor here. We don't want the turnover. We are investing too much into this and it's got to be the right person. We don't want a job hopper, so to speak. What they fail to see is, hold on a second, look how much experience is coming to the table based on the breadth of work this person has just done over the last several years, that you can hire somebody who's been with the same company for the last 6 years and they won't come close to the coattails of somebody who has seen all these different projects. So it's a mindset thing. It really is. And I think it's an old school mindset.
I agree. And if you have somebody who has many years of regulatory experience, solid regulatory from the, you know, in a consulting capacity, the rest of that can be learned within a manufacturing environment. That's not a lot of strategy. That's understanding, you know, how to translate what you have gotten approved in a submission to how do we commercialize this? What are the labeling records? But those are things that are more black and white than, you know, from a quality perspective than a regulatory submission or strategy perspective.
Last thing I want to touch on with you is the topic that I won't let die because I feel strongly about it, and that is remote versus in-office work. And even before COVID, there was this push from regulatory professionals that we can do our job remotely. You allow market access to be in the field, medical affairs is in the field, sales is in the field. We don't have to be on site all day, every day to be effective in our job. COVID proved that when push came to shove, some would argue productivity went down. I know others who were managers at that time, who say their productivity went up by over 50%. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that they changed because they had to change. I know that you work remotely. Tell me your thoughts, because let me back up. Have you worked in a situation where you guys were all in the office on a regular basis as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what's your thought living both sides of this coin in regulatory?
So funny enough, that first job I had in consulting for 17 years, once I got married and started having a family, I was able to work remotely. I proposed to my boss that I would work remotely a couple of days a week. And again, it was unheard of unless back then you were like in sales or something, right? And you didn't come into an office. My feeling is this: if you're going to work remotely, if you're going to allow, especially, you know, anybody, but especially women who are having families, you're going to get a loyal employee and a more than responsible employee back, right? So they want to make sure that they're allowed these flexible conditions, but they're going to give back in spades, in my experience. I also feel full-time versus remote, you can have somebody in the office. And, you know, I noticed this once I started working remotely, who spends their morning, you know, having coffee and chatting, and then does a little work, and then there's lunch, and then there's a little work, and then there's a lot of chatting. So you can have somebody that wastes a lot of their day in the office just as well as you can at home. And back when I was in that consulting position and having my family, I was a top biller for 3 years in a row. So I was a top biller in the company as a remote employee. I mean, I came in the office maybe twice a week. So, you know, I had a good experience there. My boss was happy because I was, you know, billing more than most people that were in the office full time. Since then, I had mostly in-office experiences. And then this position that I have now is fully remote only because I am in Boston and my company is based in San Diego. But again, you know, there's an element of trust you have to have an employee no matter where they are. Whether they're in an office or remote, you're going to know what their work product is. You're going to have an understanding of what they're doing as you manage those employees. So I understand what you're saying about remote work. And I think you can have the same issues that you might have with a remote employee as you do with a full-time in-the-office employee.
What do you make sense of the what's your opinion of the argument that this is a very collaborative position? We have our cross-functional teams. We need to meet about projects, and everybody needs to be in the same room.
Mm-hmm. I think there is some merit to that. I do. But it doesn't have to be full-time. Right. So it can be a hybrid schedule, which most companies are allowing. I will say that for younger employees, I do think being in the office more, you know, at least 3 days per week is very important because they do need that mentoring. They may need that, you know, more collaborative environment and being in an office setting with other employees while they're learning the trade, right? But after that, I think, you know, a flexible schedule is just fine. But the other thing, I'm sure you've heard this as well, Mitch, many companies that have required their employees to be back full time, when they have meetings, nobody still leaves their office. They're taking their meetings on their computer with their door shut. So what's the difference there?
I literally just saw an article on LinkedIn the other day. It's like, you're driving us back to the office so that we can sit in our office on Teams talking to the people that are down the hall on
Teams. Correct. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
I really think that probably the best is the hybrid schedule. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, people call it hybrid where it's like 4 days in the office, 1 day at home. That's not hybrid. That's not hybrid.
Right.
The other challenge is Boston, San Francisco, the LA area, San Diego, where a lot of these major hubs are, the traffic is insane.
Right.
And just because you live within 45 minutes doesn't mean it takes you 45 minutes to get to work. It could take over 2 hours.
Right.
So now you're asking the person to drive 4 hours a day mm-hmm. to be in the office, to do exactly what you said, have some coffee, be in another video meeting, mm-hmm. fight the traffic to get home to their kids. Like, I just think common sense needs to be deployed and be like, is this somebody we're willing to lose because we are hard-headed about what our schedule is?
Right.
Or is there some flexibility here where we said 3 days a week, but they need it Wednesdays and Fridays instead of Tuesdays and Mondays and whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I think that it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds because, like I said, in our space, it's been very employer-driven lately as far as having the pendulum swing to employers. It's
yes.
going to swing back. And
it
when
is.
It does, it's going to be in a big way. And I think that mm-hmm. there's going to continue to be this push-pull about how do we manage our work schedules and the environments that we ask people to work in.
Agree. And I think many organizations will lose good employees if they force the 5 day, work requirement.
Yeah. What a competitive advantage for organizations who are willing to be flexible.
Yes. Yep.
So, listen, I can't thank you enough for being here and all the nuggets that you've shared. I've got nothing but respect for you and what you've done with your career. I learned that you were in part of a family of eight, which I had no idea, which is awesome. Last but not least, we're going to certainly put up a link to your profile on LinkedIn. We'll put a link to the organization's website. But anything that you would like to speak about as far as what's going on, what you guys are excited about as of late?
In my corporation?
Yeah.
My company? Yeah. So, yeah, I work for ClearPoint Neuro, and You know, we have a navigational stereotactic platform that allows neurosurgeons to access the brain for a number of different areas, including like deep brain stimulation, you know, cancer treatment, laser treatment. But we partner with over 50 gene therapy and drug companies for deliveries of gene therapy or drugs to the brain. And we just got our first approval in November with our partner, PTC Therapeutics, for addressing a rare disease in children. So that's very exciting that I feel like we're really helping, you know, kids with rare diseases to reach some milestones that they normally would not. So I look forward to, you know, moving forward in these areas because ClearPoint has such a promising technology, and you know, it's a very solid, thorough, competent company. So I really look forward to addressing some of those unmet needs, especially in the pediatric population. It's very interesting and exciting, and hopefully will, you know, help many, many children.
Amazing stuff. Well, congrats to you and the team for hard-fought battles to obviously deliver impactful patient care. That's amazing stuff. We certainly wish you guys the best. Like I said, I'm going to put up links so that people who have been encouraged by this podcast and want to learn more can reach out.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Mitch. I appreciate this.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. For more content-rich episodes, log on to theanthonymichaelgroup.com or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform.